Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Friday the 13th, January 13th, 2012, and this is podcast number 82. Again, podcasting from the motorhome. Now, I've complained about the sound quality of our podcast, and someone very kindly told me that they didn't think our sound was so bad, but today you may notice a lot more of a rumble. We've got the real live winter has struck Missouri, and so we have all the heating devices going to try to keep the motorhome livable and not have all the pipes freeze and the doggies and the cats and everybody freezing to death in here. So today you probably will hear some background noise, but you probably won't hear road traffic or roosters or auto bodies or any of those things, because with having the rumble of all the heating going on in the motorhome, it kind of fades out all the rest of the noise. Also, you may detect in my voice I'm still fighting with a cold, so so bear with me. I probably sound like someone who has a cold. Okay, so, well, first off, I want to do what I've done for a couple days here. I want to read this again from L. Neil Smith, because this is just so, I just want to go over this again. This is about the non-aggression principle. A libertarian is a person who believes that no one has the right under any circumstances to initiate force against another human being or to advocate or delegate its initiation. Those who act consistently with this principle are libertarians, whether they realize it or not. Those who fail to act consistently with it are not libertarians, regardless of what they may claim. L. Neil Smith. And, of course, a little disclaimer that that does not preclude the existence of self-defense. Part of the non-aggression principle, or the zero-aggression principle, is that you can defend yourself as vigorously as you feel you need to. Okay, I just wanted to throw that out again because it's just such a good explanation there by L. Neil Smith. Okay, and I should mention, especially since Nikki is chewing on some dog food over there, we have with us, as always, Nikki the dog and Baggy the cat. Baggy's a little freaked out by the engine of the motorhome running, so she's taken hiding probably under one of the chairs or one of the places she likes to hide when the motorhome engine is running. But Nikki seems unaffected and really doesn't care what we're doing over here. So now to get to the point of today's podcast, I wanted to do this for Thursday's podcast, but I knew going in even Wednesday night, I was feeling so bad from this head cold that I knew Thursday morning I would wake up and there would be no way I could talk to a microphone. And sometimes I record the podcast the night before or something like that. I wasn't even able to do that then. So I was lucky to be able to even sit still long enough to mix two old podcasts together. But I'm feeling a lot better today. So so this podcast was supposed to be Thursday's podcast. A good friend of mine named Kelly that I've known on the internet for a few years now. I haven't actually met him in real life, but he's one of those people that you really get to know on the internet, and he's a really solid person. He shared with me a podcast from This American Life. It's a podcast that actually is It's a radio version of a speech that Mike Daisy gives with regards to a trip he took to China, and it's a really good podcast. I may put a link to it. I'm not sure. I'll have to kick this around a little bit because I'm not really sure. Yeah, I probably will put a link to the podcast itself because it's really worth listening to. It's really interesting. I don't agree with everything Mike Daisy says and does in the podcast. It's not Mike Daisy's podcast, by the way. It's a different podcaster who was moved by Mike Daisy's speech and therefore played the thing in its entirety. And as I said, I don't necessarily agree with everything Mike Daisy, with all the conclusions that he comes to, and that's what I was going to talk about today. And I'm not necessarily even shocked by his story. It's pretty much, he draws a visual picture that pretty much matches what I already believed. I'm not entirely isolated from what's going on in China. My brother has been over there, oh my, I'd be afraid to even estimate how many times. He's spent sometimes months in China through his employment, through his job. And he has pictures, and he and I have talked quite a bit about it, the conditions over there and everything. So I wasn't at all surprised by Mike Daisy's description of the working circumstances. But it's, he still, he portrays it in this talk, in a way that's very, very touching. And well, let me get into it here. He decides to go to China to find out. Mike Daisy is a real Apple computer person, an Apple, fanatic of the Apple religion. And that's how he puts it. So he decides to go to China and find out how these Apple computers and toys and gadgets and doodads were made. He says that he had thought that they were made by robots, like sort of like the way Japanese automotive plants are run. So, and then one day he got a new iPhone, and it had four test pictures left over from the factory, from when they evidently just tested it in the factory. And this intrigued him, and it inspired him to go ahead and go to China and see the factories where these things are made. And that's what his talk is about. I believe the pronunciation of the city is Shenzhen, China, where almost all electronic stuff is made. When we think of things coming from China, we tend to think of a large country, a massive country. Actually, China is huge, both in population and in geography, in geographic terms. But we tend to think of these things from China as coming from, you know, the way someone would say something is from the U.S. Well, you know, they're manufacturing in pretty much all 50 states, and so it could come from anywhere in the United States if it comes from the U.S. But that's really not the case in China. There are small, considering the size of China, there are small manufacturing districts where everything is squeezed into one area where it can be tightly controlled and managed. And Shenzhen is one of those places where it's where all the manufacturing is crammed into one spot. So if you have an electronic device of some kind, or pretty much anything that has a motherboard in it, it probably came from that area of China, and it probably came from the huge Foxconn plant, Foxconn industrial manufacturing facility that's there. As Mike starts off his speech, he says that driving through the city, he says it looks like, and this is a quote from him, so it's not, I'm sorry for the graphics, but he says that it looks like Blade Runner threw up on itself. Now that's the way he describes the city itself. He says the air is so dirty that it feels like a boot pushing against your chest until eventually you get used to it, and then you don't notice it, because if you've been there long enough, you just kind of forget how filthy the air is. And my brother gave me that impression as well. He told me that he had that impression as well, that it's just like it's just like the air is thick and heavy from all the pollution in the air. Now, in this speech, Mike Daisy says that his plan was to go to the Foxconn factory and just interview the workers at the factory gates. Now, if you're familiar with Foxconn, there was a story out not long ago, I suppose it's been a couple years probably, about a security guard, and Mike mentions it in this, that he had recalls getting the story that a Rutgers photographer was taking photographs near the factory, and the security guards from the Foxconn factory attacked and beat the photographer for taking pictures too close to the factory. So they're very protective. So he was a little concerned about just going up to the gate and talking to workers. The Foxconn is the factory that actually makes the motherboards and all those other parts and things and stuff and all kinds of gadgetry that we think of. They employ about, are you ready for this? They employ about 430,000 workers at that one plant. And as he gets there, a funny thing, Mike Daisy calls this a Stalinist dream. A Stalinist dream. Interesting. I'm going to come back to that point in a minute. You may have seen some stories lately about Foxconn. It was in the news just in the last couple weeks because they settled. They made an agreement to try to head off a threatened mass suicide of hundreds of employees had threatened to all kill themselves at the same time if the working conditions and agreements were not made to settle back wages and so forth like this with the Foxconn employees. And Mike Daisy, in talking about this, he talks about how he saw these nets that were stretched around the tops of the buildings to catch the workers who would climb to the top of the buildings and then jump out. And so they put nets around the top of the buildings to catch the suicidal workers to try to keep them from committing suicide like this. Now, the actual podcaster goes back and debunks this a little bit at the end of the podcast. And he says, well, you know, in all truthfulness, there's not really any evidence that the Foxconn employees have any worse suicide rate than the rest of China, but China does have one of the worst suicide rates of any country in the world. But another thing that Mike Daisy says there is that what he alleges that child labor is used at Foxconn. And he kind of alleges that it's very, the child labor is heavily utilized. Now, again, the podcaster debunks this accusation at the end of the podcast. But it's still very emotional and central to the theme that Mike Daisy is putting across, that there is a lot of child labor. And honestly, I think that there's probably more than most of these companies would like us to know about. I'm not sure if it's as common as Mike Daisy portrays, or if it's less of a problem like companies like Apple and so forth want us to believe. Probably somewhere in the middle. But, that's a child labor is a whole different topic, and it's a thing that the left likes to exploit and the right likes to not think about. But anyway, we'll get that. We'll get child labor on a different podcast. One of the other things, though, that Mike says is that out on the assembly line, in the actual workings of the factory at Foxconn, you're not allowed to speak. No, none of the workers are allowed to speak. It's dead silence. At all times, dead silence. They stand at their workplace and they assemble, and they do this for 12, 16 hours a day, just continuously, and there's no speaking, there's no breaks, there's no, you know, going off for a coffee break, there's no going off for a cigarette break, there's no walking away and stretching your legs, none of that. You stand at your workstation for 12 to 16 hours or more a day, and you just assemble and assemble and assemble. And then he goes on to mention that while he was there, a worker died after working a 34-hour shift. And he portrays that as being not all that uncommon. Now, of course, there is a problem with this. Even in a country like China with unlimited labor, it's not really in the best interest of the company to work your employees to death. And in the latter part after the speech is over, the podcaster talks to Mike Daisy about that and talks with other sources and says that indeed they're working with Foxconn and other companies like that to show them how to keep their employees trained so that you don't have the turnover rate, and so that you don't have to work the workers to that extent. But still, I believe Mike is probably telling the truth when he says that there are workers who are just worked to death. In the process of this story that he weaves for us, Mike Daisy talks about going through and seeing the dormitories where the workers, where the sleeping quarters for the workers, and he says that it's a series of cement cubicles about 12 by 12 with up to 15 beds stacked to the ceilings, just jammed into these little cubicle sleeping areas. And he says all this is done under the watch of cameras. There are cameras in the dormitory rooms, there are cameras in the halls, there are cameras everywhere watching the workers all the time, from the time they wake up to all the steps that they go through to complete their working day, come back, climb back into their cubicle, back into their, he refers to it as being coffin-like existence in the cubicles, and back to sleep. And cameras are watching them at all times. Then, at about this point in the conversation, he strikes for what he perceives to be the root of the problem. And I'm going to quote him here for you. He says, "When we dream of a future where the regulations are washed away and the corporations are finally free to sail above us, you don't have to dream about some sci-fi dystopian Blade Runner 1984 beep." I put that in because they beeped out what he said. "You can go to Shenyang tomorrow. They're making your crap that way today." It's very emotional. I want to read that one more time for you. And I'll just, the beep is where they bleep out his word. But "when we dream of a future where the regulations are washed away and the corporations are finally set free to sail above us, you don't have to dream about some sci-fi dystopia Blade Runner 1984 beep. You can go to Shenyang tomorrow. They're making your crap that way today." Now, of course, I can't come anywhere near the level of emotion that Mike Daisy does in this speech. He's a professional at giving emotional speeches. It's what he does for a living. So he can say these things in a way that really tugs at your emotions and at your heart. He also says, and this is another quote, he says, "There are more handmade things now than there have ever been in the history of the world. Everything is handmade. I know. I've been there, and I've seen the workers laying parts thinner than a human hair, one after another after another." Very emotional. Okay, I'll come back to his attack of the... When he says, I'll just point this out and then I'll come back to it. When he says that this future where regulations are washed away and corporations are fully free to sail above us, just keep that in mind, that he also called it a Stalinist dream, and now he's saying that it's a place, a dystopia, where a 1984 Blade Runner dystopia where regulations are washed away. And realize, he's in China. He's in a country that is entirely, it's sort of the state taken to its highest logical conclusion. It's the one location in the world where the state has remained continuous longer than anywhere else in the world. Now, of course, you've heard me talk about Jericho over and over, and the birth of the state at Jericho, and the state was in Jericho long before it was in China. But it came and died, and came back to life and died again, and came back to life and died again, over and over in Jericho. The state has lived continuously since pre-Roman times in China. It has never died. It is there now, and it has been there for about 2,500 years. So if someone wants to make the argument that the state, you know, I say all the time that the state will collapse on its own weight. If someone And nobody ever catches me on this. I'm waiting for someone to make this argument to me. Well, what about China? China's existed for about 2,500 years, and they haven't collapsed on themselves. Ah, but I'm not going to answer that today. But I will, because I'm getting off my topic. So here we are in China, a place where the state has run wild, and the state has been taken to its ultimate destination. And he's seeing the result of the state. And somehow it's because the state's not strong enough. Somehow it's because corporations are run wild. In the largest, most successful, continuous communist country, the state is not powerful enough. You need more regulations, more state activity. Very strange. Okay, so now then we go into another thing, and I've got a problem with this. He starts talking about how he met with this, what he calls a secret union, and that there are secret union members, and these people work to try to help the workers and try to get reform done and so forth like this. And I find it interesting that he calls it a secret union, and that's typically what the media refers to these groups in China as, secret unions. And as workers' unions of different kinds. But what I find highly doubtful is that the word union could... I doubt that it has to be translated. Whatever the Chinese word that the Chinese are using, I find it highly unlikely that it's required to translate that into English as the word union. I would bet that there's probably dozens of other words that would translate just as easy as translating that as a union into English. But the liberal mind of the media that runs all this stuff, they're going to pick the word union because that's such a liberal concept. And I'm not against unions. I take the same position with unions that Rothbard and Mises did. Like every other association, as long as it's voluntary, I don't have a problem with it. When it becomes required, or when they forcibly extract money from one person that doesn't want to be a part of their union, and they force them to pay for their union, or when they force someone to join their union, or when the union uses the power of the state to bring about force, then I've got a problem with a union. And you see, that's the perfect liberal union. All of what I just described, the bad aspects of a union, is exactly what the liberal thinks of as being good when they think of a union. So, but I doubt very seriously if that's what we're talking about is happening in China with their unions. These people are risking their lives to be involved in these organizations that are attempting to bring reform. So when we think of unions in the free world, or what we laughingly refer to as the free world, most of the time what we're talking about is an organization that forces their members to join and forces their members to pay union dues. And it's just the opposite with these reformers in China. They risk their lives to be a part of these reforming organizations. I'm hesitant to even say that they're unions, and as I describe them, they're risking their lives in this. This is not at all something like the AFL-CIO or whatever that we have in the U.S. where your wages are forcibly taken from you, whether you like it or not, and they support some organization that then uses that money for political means, whether you agree with those means or not. It's totally the opposite of what is going on with these organizers in China. Okay, now... then he goes on to tell a very stirring story about people, these workers that are exposed to a chemical called N-hexane. And N-hexane is a potent neurotoxin that destroys nerve function. And he talks about how that they use it to wipe the screens clean on the iPhones and these other toys that they make over there. And once a worker is exposed to it daily for about 10 years or so, they become useless to the factory and are just discarded and replaced like a bad part in a machine. And he very vividly describes this. You really have to hear this. And it's horrible. It's a horrible, tragic story. Again, it doesn't surprise me, knowing what I've been told from my brother and from others about the working standards over there. It doesn't surprise me. It saddens me. At the end, the podcaster somewhat debunks this and somewhat verifies it at the same time. He kind of says, yeah, that's been going on, but some companies are doing this and that, and they're trying to get away from it and so forth. But it's still going on. So this, again, falls back to the same argument that you're being told, that if they just had regulations, if the state were just stronger, that's what the problem is. No indication that, hey, you know what? These corporations exist because the state allows them to exist, because the state protects them, because the state keeps the factory workers from rightfully suing them, because the state creates a situation where they have to go there and they have to do these things, otherwise they starve. We ignore all that, and we want to demonize the companies, or we want to demonize the Americans who buy the iPods and iPads and other items. Well, never mind, I'm not going to attack Apple. This is not the Attack Apple podcast. Anyway, the liberals always try to fall back on liberal American guilt to try to make it somehow your fault that corporations are in bed with the government in China and they're doing these horrible things, and it's all your fault because you bought an iPhone. Anyway, getting away from the guilt and getting back to the thing here. He goes on to talk about how the different workers that he's interviewed and the very, very dramatic stories that he was told. He talks about this worker that was blacklisted, and the worker, because the worker had complained to the labor board about the circumstances, so they put the worker's name on the blacklist. And then the worker gets fired and can't get hired anywhere else because their name is on the blacklist. So he has a copy of one of these blacklists, and he has his translator read it. And he says that right across the... Let me quote exactly what he says about this. In a fascist country run by thugs, you don't have to be subtle. You can say exactly what you mean. The sheet, he's talking about the blacklist, the sheet is very clear that it comes from the labor board, and it says right across the top, the following is a list of troublemakers. If any of them are found in your employ, you must dismiss them immediately. Then there's column after column after column and of names, pages after pages after pages of them. Okay, so what he's saying is, I find it interesting that after he's already told us that it was a Stalinist dream, and then he goes on to essentially say that he blames the evil capitalist corporations for this, and that what they need is regulation, and then he goes on to say that it's a fascist country run by thugs. He's very dramatic about this, and I do believe the bulk of what he's saying. I'm not in any way indicating that he's not telling the truth. And it really is worth listening to, because, I think most Americans don't know. First off, they don't know why it's so much cheaper to go down to Walmart and buy some kind of cheap Chinese thing rather than buying something that's made in the USA. And this is not a Made in the USA podcast either. This is not, I'm not here telling you, oh, we got to buy American. No, listen. I'll do another podcast. Maybe when Kai's with me, we can take on the, debunk the myth of buy American. I'm not saying you should run out and buy Chinese. I'm not saying you should buy American. I'm saying you should buy whatever you need to buy as cheaply as you can get it. That's the smart way of doing this. What takes place prior to you buying it is not your responsibility. However, what I did want to point out was that it is worth listening to this, to Mike Daisy's story, and it is worthwhile to hear how he describes how the workers are treated over there and what they go through. But just keep in mind, as you're hearing this, he refers to a Stalinist dream, he blames the lack of regulation, and he calls it a fascist country, and yet he never sees past his own statist glasses to see what the real root cause of this is. Why? How is it that a corporation can treat its employees like this? How does it get away with this? How is it that the workers don't just rise up and burn the factory down? How is it that the people tolerate a government this oppressive? How is it that a people are that beaten down, that they are in that level of desperation that they have to put nets around the top of the building? How does a country get to that position? And because of the tint of his socialist glasses, he never sees the root cause in this. And of course, the root cause is the state. It's the state that has systematically for 2,500 years, generation after generation after generation of programming, taught the people of China to bow their head and tolerate it. And this has only gotten worse since the state went from what you might consider a normal state under the empire, under the emperor, to a more socialist blend. Now, he doesn't really realize it. It's kind of comical, him comparing it to both being Stalinist and fascist. That really shows the level of his confusion about economics and government in general. But then again, you know, most people don't really understand how polluted society is by the very existence of the state and how many ways that the state affects life. But really, what you need to realize when you listen to his description, set aside his dramatic leftist, heart-tugging phrases and accusations, and realize that what he's describing is the natural position the state will drive everybody to if it gets the chance. If it has the opportunity to exist long enough, the world he describes will be everywhere the state is. And that, now, when we look ahead at the future, and I've kind of talked about this a little bit before, we look ahead to the future, we think of what the United States, and we think of what Canada and Mexico, and we look at what Europe's going through right now. Okay, we had an interruption there in the podcast. That's one of the fun things about doing it from a motorhome. And so I'm really not sure where I was and what I was talking about, so please forgive me for not having better notes and following along and knowing what I'm talking about. So I'll just try to pick back up as best I can, having no idea where I was in the in my storyline. The one thing I wanted to emphasize, though, is I think maybe I was talking about the future. Yeah. Whether you're in the U.S. or Canada, Mexico, Europe, even Australia, there eventually this is going to be. Think of it this way. I was watching the Turner Classic Movies channel the other night, and there was an old Spencer Tracy movie on, and forgive me for not having the notes ready for it and everything, because this just popped into my mind, and I hadn't really planned on talking about this, but so I can't even remember the name of the movie. But in the movie, Spencer Tracy was portraying a man who had just got fed up with the way government was going, and he decides to run for president as a Republican, and he has all these great high-minded reforms in mind, and he's going to do all these wonderful things, and yet he ends up selling out to the Republican machine and becoming a part of the process, and then eventually he comes to his senses and resigns from the race and resigns from the party. And at one point, when he's really expressing his true feelings about things, he indicates that the only way that we're ever going to have true peace and true prosperity is if we have a one world government where we, speaking of, you know, typically these people who come across with this kind of thing, when they say that, you know, we want this or we want that, really what that means is they want that. And his, the thing that he portrays is sort of the standard Wilsonian concept that somehow America can lord over the world and bring peace to everybody else because we'll make them behave the way that we want, and we'll bring them the democracy that we want, and we'll make them become just like us, and then we'll run everything, and it, you know, and they don't say it in harsh terms like I'm saying it. They say it with buttery language, and oh, it just sounds so wonderful. But here's the real point: what Spencer Tracy was portraying there in a positive light is really the way a lot of these people, both on the left and the right, think. They think if they can just get control of everything, they'll make everything better. When in fact, getting control of everything is the problem. But if you think it through, again, what will the future bring to us? Well, the natural, if you see, if a little bit of state, if it's good to use a little bit of violence and a little bit of theft and a little bit of aggression to make people behave in a certain way, and they still behave in a different way, then it's, if that's good to do that, then it's good to use more aggression and more theft and more violence to try to bring them into behaving the way you want. And if they don't behave that way, then it's better to bring even more violence and more threats of violence and more aggression and more theft. So if you really think about what is the natural progression of the state, what could it possibly do in the future? And the answer is that it has to grow. It continually has, for all these thousands of years, it has continually grown and grown and grown, and continually shifted itself and changed itself to adapt to be, each time that it dies or almost dies, it adapts itself to become more aggressive and more controlling, and controlling more and more aspects of human behavior, so that eventually the logical end of the state is exactly what Mike Daisy was seeing in that Foxconn plant, where the workers go back to cubicles where they sleep stacked like cordwood in little cement rooms, and they're watched at all times, and they leave there, and they go single line down to the assembly plant, and they stand there on their feet for 12 or 14 hours a day, and they do nothing but assemble parts and build things. And then off in some other distance is a corporate farm doing pretty much the same thing. And off in the distance somewhere is some other type of corporate setting where everybody sits in a cubicle and punches numbers into computers. And all of this is the ultimate of what the state wants. It's to have you in a little box where that your labor feeds the state, and your efforts and all you, everything that you make and everything that you do is controlled by the state. That's the logical end of thinking about the state. And yes, the state always has to have wars going on, because it has to have people in a panic so that they can always think that however bad things are now, we have to do this to keep the bad guys from coming and getting us. You constantly have to have Hannibal at the gate. That I remember that from being a little kid. I think maybe it was my sixth grade teacher that told us the story of how parents, and who knows if this is really true or not, but how parents in Rome would tell their children that if they didn't behave, that Hannibal would get them, and they were constantly saying that Hannibal's at the gate. And, of course, there was a lot of fear in Rome of Hannibal because he had come close to actually defeating Rome. But the point is that you have to constantly be scaring the people with a boogeyman in order to keep the state in position and keep the state as the dominant force. And unless you're always afraid of somebody from the outside getting you, then you can't have the perpetual war, and you can't have all the things that the state needs in order to perpetuate itself. And so what will the state ultimately do? Well, if you really think about this 1984 story, it really is the logical conclusion. You have the state, one single state, divided up into several pieces that constantly is at war with itself for the single purpose of keeping its people afraid of those other people. And everybody is constantly monitored, and everybody is constantly working, and everybody is constantly afraid. And this is the ultimate of what the state has to come to. It has to come to this at some point in time. It has to come to a one-world state, not necessarily a one-world government. You might have this state divided into three or four governments, but at some point in time, this is the logical end of the state. And that's the point of where the state will start to run out of new things to conquer, and it will start to devour the host. It will start to be more of a burden than the workers can support. And that's when the state will begin to get really ugly and really nasty. And when's that going to happen? Well, it's not going to happen immediately. It's probably more than one generation away. Might be longer than that. You see, I'm not so paranoid about the you know, a lot of the things that a lot of the people or the Alex Jones types are really worried about right now. I know that those things will come, but I don't think that the actual people in the United States would tolerate a whole lot of that right now. But it will come. There will be concentration camps of one sort or another. There always are. There will be constant monitoring everywhere, cameras everywhere watching. They will. But whether or not it's in this generation or the next, it's kind of hard to tell. But now this begs the question, what can be done about this? And this begs the answer, us, those of us who see what the state really is. We have to, for the sake of future generations, we have to start building the underground economy now so that generations can fall back on it and they can live without the state. We need to devise ways so that we can exist right under the nose of the state and it doesn't even know we're there. We need to devise language tools so that we can communicate when they shut down avenues of communication like the current internet that we have. As we figure these things out, the state will adapt as well. I've heard people talk about, well, no, now that we've got the internet, they'll never keep a cap on us. Well, yes and no. You know, the internet's a great tool given to us for the purpose of liberty, and I'm thrilled that we have it. But the state in China is already in the process of shutting it down. And we saw what the state did in places like Egypt when these were happening. And you say, oh, well, yeah, but they worked around it. They did, exactly. And we will, too. And whoever the generation is when this happens, they will, too. We will always be one step ahead of the state. But we have to be. And that's what I'm encouraging now. How can we be one step ahead of the state today? Well, it's by figuring out ways to not use Federal Reserve notes, to prepare for financial collapse, so that when the next bubble pops, it doesn't pop in your face, so that your assets and the things that you own are not kept in a way that they're vulnerable to the next phase of this thing happening. And that is how it happens. It happens in bubbles and phases over and over. And a little by little by little, not only is liberty taken away, but wealth is taken away too. And the people become impoverished and eventually desperate. And eventually they'll tolerate Foxconn factories all over, everywhere. They'll tolerate that because they don't see a choice. They don't know that things could be different. And all that time, we have to develop ways to get around that and ways to work underneath it and beside it without ever being detected. And remember, I've said this over and over. The way to defeat the state is not in attacking the state. The way to defeat the state is to stop supporting the state, stop believing in the state, and share that with others so that their eyes are opened and so that they can stop believing in the state. Keep in mind, when I'm talking about the state, really what we're talking about here is a combination of socialism and racketeering. The state, in every way, it's been referred to over and over and over as being like the mafia. And that's because it's such a good comparison. If you go back into Sicilian history, Sicily, the state in Sicily was the mafia for a very long time. And in many ways, it was a functional state, in many ways, more better for the people than many of the other states in other locations. So what we look at today as the mafia is simply a state that had to go underground. It's sort of a black market state. But that's really what the state is. It is a syndicated racketeering operation that utilizes socialism so that enough people are in on the theft that they can keep the racket going. And by that, what that means is they're not going to start killing people en masse in the way that a lot of people think of. I'm not saying there will never be mass killing again by the state. There will be. The state does that over and over and over. But mostly, the state needs its workers alive. It needs them producing. It needs them numb, and it needs them staying in line, continuing, keeping the presses going, keeping the assembly line going, keeping all those things flowing. The state needs those people all alive and working constantly. And so it's not going to intentionally kill off a lot of people, but that's not to say there won't be more mass murder. The state is well known for that. Just look at the 20th century and how many people the state just outright murdered during the 20th century. So hopefully this hasn't been too much of a doom and gloom podcast, because really what I want to impress upon you is things might, in the next generation, things might get pretty nasty in the U.S., but there's still a window of time to prepare for these things. And I'm talking about at least a couple generations, at least one generation or two, to make preparations for these things. And the preparations we make, you know, here's some things to think about. In the 1840s and 1850s, across places like Ohio and Indiana and Illinois, when people would build a new house, they would very often build into the house hiding places and even tunnels under the house, and tunnels as escape routes underneath the house. And the reason that they did this is because they knew they could see firsthand how the state was reacting with runaway slaves. So, for example, the town that I live in Ohio is they even have a Underground Railroad museum there, and it was one of the main points on the Underground Railroad. And I have been down in some of the old houses that were built in the 1840s and 1850s, And I have seen the hiding spaces and the tunnels. And there are even, in the old part of town, there were tunnels that connected numerous houses. So that when they came in to search one house, they could slip the slaves, the escaping slaves, through those tunnels and out a different house to get them away from there. And so, literally, and this town was built primarily by Quakers, so this was in their thinking when they laid the town out and when they built their original buildings. And you see the same kind of thing in buildings that were built in the 1920s during Prohibition. You see buildings built with secret rooms underneath in the basement, and secret walls that shift and go into a secret room where alcohol would have been kept or made. Tunnels. There's several shows on TV that talk about these buildings that were built during Prohibition, where speakeasies were hidden in the basement or hidden in rooms or whatever, and tunnels that lead out to special places and all these kind of things. And these people were adapting to the oppression that they were feeling from the state at the time. So what I'm saying is, today, 2012, if you're building a house, you know, take that little extra step and build into it hidden rooms. Take that little extra step and build into it hidden storm cellars or hidden escape routes. And there's reasons for this as well. If you think about it, every house should have, even if you're not in a tornado zone, like we think about these things in Ohio and here where we're at in Missouri, you think about tornadoes, you know, for like 4 or 5 months of the year, it's on your mind. So for practical terms, it's good to have a storm cellar. But even if you live in a place where tornadoes are not common, it's still good to have an underground room to store things as far as food items and things that you'd like to maintain a steady temperature with. So there are practical reasons, even if the state were never to grow, but it will grow. The state, we know the state is going to do these things. So if you're already building a building, incorporate this stuff into that building. If you're already planning on doing something, then incorporate aspects of ways that the black market can be utilized for later on. And as we get in a habit of thinking that way, and as we teach a generation of children that we're raising up to think that way, then we teach a generation that's more prepared for the activity that the state is going to bring upon us. Well, like I said, I hope this wasn't too much of a doom and gloom type thing. You know, I really don't want it to be, but I can see how the state is changing and how it's going to become, how it's going to become something a lot more than it is. And so if I didn't give warnings, and if I didn't, you know, Penn Jillette said this one time. He said, of course, Penn Jillette is an atheist. He doesn't believe in God. And he said that he understands why people try to evangelize, because I'm going to mess up his quote. But let's say he's standing there in the road and there's a bus coming at him and he doesn't believe in the bus. But if somebody else believes that the bus is coming right at him and does nothing to try to get him out of the way of the bus, then he finds that repulsive. So he understands why people who have faith and who believe will want to run out and try to grab him and pull him away, even though he doesn't believe there's a bus coming at him. Now, along that same lines, that's kind of the way I think about with the state. I am convinced of what this thing is going to become and what it's going to look like in the future and what we're going to have to do to adapt to stay ahead of it. And if I can encourage people not to be complacent, not to assume things are always going to be as they are today, not to believe the lies of the state that things are getting better, things are getting worse. We have a lot less freedom today than we had 100 years ago. And 100 years ago, they had a lot less freedom than 100 years prior to that. And there was a lot less freedom than 100 years prior to that. Each generation, we're losing freedom. We're not gaining more freedom. This myth that we're progressing towards something better is a lie of the state. We're progressing within the existence of the state. We're progressing towards a very bad future until the state dies. And during the moments of the state's death, it's going to be really, really ugly. And the more prepared we are generationally for that when it happens, the better we can just step to the side and let the bus go by. Okay, I need to wrap this up, otherwise I'll just go on and start repeating myself and repeating myself. Kelly, thanks a lot for sharing that podcast with me. I really enjoyed it, and I hope I didn't make it sound too leftist or too bad, because it really was a good podcast, and I do appreciate listening to it. I've actually heard it 3 times now. I really enjoyed it. Okay, so I need to cut this off. Folks, thank you very much for listening to the BadQuaker.com podcast. For, as I always say, I should give this disclaimer too. I can't get to my email. I was able to yesterday for a moment, but I'm having trouble because of the computers that I'm trying to use to get to my stuff. So if you've emailed me and I haven't responded to you, I'm trying to get to it. I'm just having difficulties with the computers I'm dealing with. So, and if you want to email me, it's ben@badquaker.com. And for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Thanks a lot.